From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're keeping an eye on Hurricane Joaquin, which has strengthened to a Category 1 hurricane and is bearing down on the Bahamas.
And it could hit the East Coast, which is already dealing with flooding in some areas today. Joining us from Atlanta is Brian Norcross, a senior hurricane specialist at the Weather Channel. Brian, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And a lot of regions in the East Coast already starting to see heavy rain and winds. What are you most concerned about when it comes to flooding?
I'm very concerned about flooding for the entire East Coast, really, from the Carolinas all the way up to New England, really because it's a 1-2-3 punch here. We had tremendous rains in parts of Virginia and North Carolina yesterday, not related to Hurricane Joaquin. And then we're going to get another round of some rain, and then what's called a precursor event to the actual hurricane arrives late on Thursday into Friday. And then if the hurricane makes landfall, we'll get this third event here. So it has the potential to be a tremendous flood. In any case, it's going to be a serious flood.
And when it comes to the hurricane itself, what's the current projection about where it's going to go and whether it's going to make landfall?
Well, initially, it's going to threaten the Bahamas. So that's in the very short term, the next couple of days. And it's moving very, very slowly. So it's going to sit there and batter some of the Bahamian islands for some time. And then it begins to move to the north. And it's still very uncertain exactly what's going to happen over the weekend into very early next week. There's some possibility that this is going to become a very, very serious hurricane from the Carolinas up to the Delmarva, maybe into New Jersey, as far as a landfalling hurricane. There's also a possibility that it skirts the land and more directly affects New England, but that wouldn't be until early next week. And there is also a third possibility that it stays just far enough offshore that we get some heavy rain, we get some high surf, but really we don't get the direct effects. We're talking a number of days out still, and the science really does not allow us to pin it down any better than that. Better than to say that folks from the Carolinas North need to be ready for the possibility.
And if it does make landfall, are you expecting that it would be still a hurricane at that point or a strong tropical storm?
I would expect it to be a hurricane. If it got to New England, then it could be a strong tropical storm, but still maybe even a hurricane if it got to New England because it would be moving pretty quickly. So, yeah, we're talking about a serious hurricane potential from the Carolinas north here with this thing. No way to know anything more than that except to say that it is a possibility.
And as we said, this is just the third hurricane in the Atlantic season in 2015. It's been a pretty quiet year so far. Are you attributing that to El Nino out in the Pacific? We know that one of the effects of that is that there are fewer hurricanes or there's a weaker hurricane season in the Atlantic.
Yeah, there are two aspects to El Nino. One is that it creates unfavorable upper-level winds across the tropical Atlantic, and that just keeps down the number of storms. And that's what we've seen this year. El Nino is the direct cause of the fewer-than-normal storms. But the other thing that comes with that is if you're going to have a storm form, it normally forms close to the U.S. and probably not from regular tropical processes like tropical waves coming off of Africa and moving across the Atlantic and developing like they normally do. It comes from some other kind of system, low pressure system, that gets out over the warm water, sits there for a while, and then eventually becomes tropical. And that's exactly what we have with Joaquin. This was an upper-level low, developed thunderstorms. The thunderstorms got it spinning, turned it into a tropical system, and the conditions in this small pocket of the ocean are favorable for it to strengthen, and we've seen it strengthen quite remarkably here over the last day.
Meanwhile, Brian, as I look outside, it's raining. It's raining very hard. I see it as kind of an inconvenience, but of course we know that these things can get very dangerous, and people do end up even dying when you have heavy rains and flooding like this. What would your advice be to people across the East Coast with all this rain coming on how to stay safe?
My advice is if you live in a flood-prone area that's either near the ocean or near a river or places where it has flooded in the past when hurricanes have come in the Carolinas, remembering back to Hurricane Floyd, also in New Jersey, and every part of the East Coast has had significant flooding. So if you live in a place that is prone to flooding, just be aware of what's happening around you and know what you'll do in case the rain comes and it comes in feet which is very possible with this 1-2-3 punch of tropical moisture coming in, not to mention the issues if we do indeed get a landfalling hurricane with storm surge along the coast and damaging winds moving inland.
That's Brian Norcross, a senior hurricane specialist at the Weather Channel, joining us from Atlanta as we wait to see what's going to happen now with Hurricane Joaquin. Brian, thank you so much.
Jeremy, thank you.
Well, so it's going to be a soggy football weekend on the East Coast as high school teams barrel towards their all-important homecoming games in November. But some schools won't be playing. Now, we've spoken about concerns about pro football. A third of former pro players will end up with severe cognitive problems. And now some high school officials are paying attention. Last year, we reported on Caro High School in Michigan. They ended their season early after athletes suffered too many concussions. And now in Missouri, the Maplewood-Richmond Heights School District didn't even field a team this year. Last June, the board canceled the season because of injuries and low student participation. The team started out with 20 players, less than the state recommends, and they ended up with 15. Maplewood, Missouri School Board President Nelson Mitten is with us. And Nelson, how tough was that decision to cancel? Football is part of high school DNA.
Well, it was very hard. Less than 5 years ago, we were in the state championship. So it was extremely difficult to make this decision. But by the same token, when you simply don't have the student interest there, to some degree, the decision is dictated by that.
Yeah, and this decline isn't just in your school district. According to the National Federation of State High School Associations, male high school football participation is down 2.4% in the past 5 years, with only 1.08 million participants this year. A million, though, is still a lot. Did you have other schools contact you to talk about this decision?
Not really. We did a survey of other schools of our size within the state and found out that only one other school of our size had both a football and a soccer program for boys, both of which were in the fall here. But other than that, we really did not have other schools contact us about the decision.
So what do the kids say about this, those 15 that wanted to play, and the alumni maybe who are on your championship team?
I think they're upset and obviously concerned about it. But when you don't have the numbers and the likelihood of injury is great, I think they are understanding of that fact. The majority of students that were interested in playing varsity athletes were freshmen and sophomores who did not have a whole lot of experience, and therefore we were going to be sending them out there as a varsity team against opponents that were physically larger as well as more skilled. And when you have that sort of situation, that's just ripe for significant injuries.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering, too, if you're watching the stats this season, so far three players have died. The most recent was at Warren Hills Regional High School. This was a star quarterback, Evan Murray, there in New Jersey. His spleen, it turned out, was enlarged, and it was lacerated in a hit. And that was just this past weekend. But you know, five players died last year. You know, some might say, well, that, you know, there's hundreds and thousands of kids playing, but deaths during a sport are pretty worth noting. I'm just wondering your thoughts on as you watch that this season.
Well, obviously, deaths are the extreme. They do happen occasionally, and it is upsetting to see that. And from our perspective, though, what we were seeing were permanent injuries. We had a significant ACL tear. We had a couple of major concussions on our players, and we don't know the long-term effects of those. And I think, you know, some people are focusing on, well, this is just football. But I think any sort of sport that might have those sorts of injuries needs to be analyzed and make sure that you're providing a safe and appropriate environment for our children to enjoy sports.
But are you hearing from people who might say, maybe parents who might say, look, this is just a few years for these kids. They won't ever have that hard a hit. They're not good enough to play college football, though they certainly won't be in the pros. Teams are character building, and it's so much a part of the stuff of a town, you know, pom-poms and leaves and Thanksgiving Day games. Are you hearing that from anyone?
Surprisingly, no. I've only heard from a couple of parents in informal conversations that were concerned about that. I urged them to come to the board and speak to us about it. None of them came. We have also heard some rumblings from alumni because our high school does have a long tradition of good high school football teams. However, I believe that anyone that really analyzes the situation and looks at the fact that the students are pretty much voting with their feet, and when the team you do field is just kind of undersized and getting injured, you know, it's not appropriate to continue with that sort of sport.
So what are you going to do for homecoming weekend?
This event has caused us to refocus our entire homecoming. We are going to have a homecoming game. However, it's going to be a soccer game. And we are actually beefing up activities and doing things, knowing that the community wants this sort of homecoming celebration, and knowing that we can still provide that sort of celebration around a sport other than football, one that is being celebrated. For example, our soccer team is now ranked one of the top 10 in the area. And so we're just changing the sport for the game. We're not changing homecoming.
Nelson Mitten, president of the Maplewood Richmond Heights, Missouri School Board. Nelson, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So soccer at homecoming. Has your school been talking about discontinuing football? Let us know. hereandnow.org.
It's Here and Now, and there's news today that Russia is now conducting airstrikes in Syria to support President Bashar al-Assad in his fight against ISIS. This marks an escalation in Russia's role in a conflict that Russia was until recently not playing a major role in. The U.S. has been leading a coalition of countries targeting ISIS in Syria, and Russia's entry into the fray prompted this from President Obama in his speech to the U.N. this week.
The United States is prepared to work with any nation, including Russia and Iran, to resolve the conflict. But we must recognize that there cannot be, after so much bloodshed, so much carnage, a return to the pre-war status quo.
And a return to the pre-war status quo would seem to mean sticking to the strategy of getting rid of President Assad, who was in power before the war began in Syria, something President Obama has called for before, as have the leaders, by the way, of France and the UK. And just to remind you, what started as a peaceful protest against Assad in 2011 turned into a deadly civil war that has already cost more than 200,000 lives. Stephen Kinzer is a former foreign correspondent for The New York Times. He's a columnist at the Boston Globe and a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. And he's with us here in the studio. Stephen Kinzer, welcome back to Here and Now.
Always good to be here.
And I want to start with the fact that you do not agree with President Obama that Assad needs to go.
It's impossible to imagine that Assad can be the figure now who can bring Syrians back together. He's not going to be the conciliating leader. He doesn't represent Syrians. He doesn't even represent most Syrians. Nonetheless, he speaks for millions of Syrians. He still has a strong base of support. So the idea that before we can start to negotiate, we have to agree that Assad has no role in the future is only a way to prolong the conflict. You cannot resolve any conflict if the spoilers who can potentially upset an agreement are not in the room. We've gotten ourselves into this mindset where we only need to negotiate with our friends. And as a result, we have promoted the continuation of this conflict by refusing to accept all the parties to sit around the table and negotiate.
Well, what could the U.S. have done? Because this goes back to the Arab Spring, when the administration really got on the side of the people in every single one of these countries when they wanted to overthrow their leaders, including President Assad.
Well, in the first place, we have been systematically excluding the key players from negotiations. I take you back to a period more than 18 months ago. In January of 2014, Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, called a conference, and he asked Iran to sit at the table, and he wanted some representatives of Assad. The Americans absolutely refused to accept this. We essentially made the decision that it would be worse to sit at a table with Iran and or representatives of Assad than to allow this war to go on. So some responsibility for the horrible tragedy that's afflicting Iran has to be placed on the decision makers who refused to sit with factions in Syria with whom they disagree.
And it's not just the Americans, as we said. The British as well have come out and said that they would like President Assad to go. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron on CBS yesterday morning, who said teaming up with President Assad is a phony solution to defeating ISIS.
The point I'm making is Assad is one of the recruiting sergeants for ISIL. Because of what he's done to his people, that is one of the reasons why people are flocking to ISIL to fight for ISIL. So that method that some put forward wouldn't work.
How do you respond to that, Stephen Kinzer?
Nobody is proposing teaming up with Assad. That's not what negotiations are about. The key is, let's sit down with all the parties. And it's really sinful that we've allowed this horror to unfold because of a political reluctance to talk with one faction or another. We've never figured out what our strategic goal in Syria is. Everybody in that country is our enemy. We have no friends. Assad is our enemy. ISIS is our enemy. The Nusra Front is our enemy. Iran is our enemy. Russia is our enemy. And it's a principle of international relations that if you don't know what your strategic goals are, you're not going to achieve them.
Does the fact, though, that the Assad government has, it appears, used chemical weapons against its own people change the equation? Is it really possible for the U.S. to be talking to somebody who's done that after the U.S. warned against that?
In the first place, I think if you want to solve a crisis, you have to talk with people that you hate. That's just the way the world works. But secondly, I'd be a little careful about jumping to the conclusion that it was Assad who did that. Think of those who were the militant anti-Assad forces. What an incentive it was for them when President Obama said, if there's any chemical usage in Syria, I'm going to go crush Assad. That is the great incentive for Turkey or Saudi Arabia or some other factions to use chemical weapons. So I'd be careful about buying into the official narrative of what happened on the chemical weapons. Nonetheless, that's not to excuse Assad. His tactics have been awful. They've been criminal. Nonetheless, you don't resolve conflicts by only talking to the people who behave well.
We're speaking with Stephen Kinzer, visiting fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. And do you extend this, what you're saying, to the other conflicts that we've gotten involved in some way or another? Would Libya, for example, be better off with Gaddafi still in power right now? It's, of course, we know it's fallen into chaos, not that it was such a great place beforehand. Would Iraq be better off with Saddam Hussein still in power?
I can tell you that the Libya intervention and the decision not to negotiate in Syria are, in my view, the two biggest foreign policy mistakes that Obama has ever made. Mm. The intervention in Libya has had huge effects, not just turning Libya into a chaotic state and haven for terrorism, but the weapons that were looted from Gaddafi's arsenal have been now spread all over North Africa. Boko Haram, which is kidnapping the girls in Nigeria, is armed by weapons that were liberated from Gaddafi's arsenals after we killed Gaddafi and we blew up that regime. So let me put it this way. I was in Iraq. I covered Iraq when Saddam Hussein was in power. That was a terror regime. That was about the worst dictatorship I've ever been in. Hmm. However, if you would accept that you don't have the right to free speech, you don't have the right to criticize the government, you can then live normally. You can go to a cafe. You can go to school. You can have a job. Now, there's nothing you can decide in Iraq that will allow you to live a normal life. So it's always a mistake to destroy a political order, no matter how repressive, without knowing what comes next.
Does the U.S., though, lose some sense of moral authority if it stands with a leader like that and against the people who are rebelling against that leader, as was the case, not as much in Iraq, but certainly in Libya and in Syria?
It's not a question of moral authority. It's a question of what the alternative is. So is it better to appear that you're not supporting the side that seems by some narratives to be the freedom fighters, or to go ahead and tolerate the war, the chaos, the mass slaughter that follows? I give you a little comparison here. In 2009, you'll remember the Green Movement protests in Iran. Millions of people went out into the streets to protest against their regime. The thugs and the goons of the regime came out and beat them and repressed them. And the reaction of Iranians, who have learned painful lessons about what revolution brings, was, oh, it didn't work. We tried to change the government. They beat us. We should go home and just imagine that we'll get what we want some other time. It's better to do that than to rip the country apart. Syrians and Egyptians and Libyans did not have that experience that the Iranians had in 1979 of staging a revolution with the hopes that everything would be better and then learning what revolution really brings. So the idea that every time people raise the banner of freedom in the world, it's strategically wise for the United States and good for the people of that country for the U.S. to stand behind them sounds good, but look at the results it has brought.
I want to bring you back to today's news about Russian airstrikes in Syria and Russia, it seems, being more in coordination with the Assad government about who they're going after. Let's listen to a piece of tape here. This is John Kerry, the Secretary of State, speaking to CNN this week. He was asked about President Putin's actions there.
If he's going to side with Assad and with Iran and Hezbollah, he's going to have a very serious problem with the Sunni countries in the region. So this is very complicated for him. He needs to work something out, and it's an opportunity, to be honest with you. I think it's an opportunity for us to force this question of how you actually resolve the question of Syria.
It was pointed out, Stephen Kinzer, in the New York Times today, that when Russia says it's going after ISIS targets, as pointed out by the Syrian government, that those may just be targets that the Syrian government calls anybody that's opposed to it a member of ISIS.
Certainly, the entry of Russia into this conflict adds a new complicating factor. But it is the product of the fact that Russia didn't have any other way to get involved. They could not become involved diplomatically because we refused to speak with them. Now, slowly, we're starting to hear a change. That the United States might be ready to talk to Russia and might be ready to talk to Iran. That's about 4 years and 200,000 deaths too late. And although we may be concerned about the long-term implications of increased Russian influence in Syria, what's worse, that or a continuation of the carnage we're seeing in Syria?
Do you see any likelihood that there will be a total change in strategy toward fighting ISIS in Syria now as a result of all that's happened in the last week or so?
Our confusion about our strategy in Syria is so profound, it's hard for me to imagine how we're going to dig our way out of this unless we sit down with all the factions. We have to decide who it is that we want to defeat, and we haven't really figured that out. We want to crush essentially every faction in Syria except for these very small, possibly non-existent so-called moderate fighters. This idea that we're going to go in and train our own forces seems to me to fly in the face of everything we've seen in recent years. So the idea that we're going to be able to create a new force is a fantasy. We need to negotiate with others to find a solution.
Stephen Kinzer, a former foreign correspondent for the New York Times, columnist at the Boston Globe and senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown. Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
And starting tomorrow in Oregon, people 21 or older will be able to walk into a medical marijuana dispensary and buy pot for recreational use. But there are some places around the state where that will not be allowed, dozens of communities where officials have banned such sales. Chris Lehman from the Northwest News Network visited one of the towns that's just saying no to recreational pot.
Across the street from a fast food joint in La Grande, Oregon, you can buy marijuana if you know where to look.
There's no marijuana leaves. There's no any of that. We just have open sign and a green cross in the window.
That's Ronna Lindsay, the owner of Highway 30 Cannabis. The medical marijuana dispensary has been open just over a year. And despite the low-key storefront, she says business is brisk. It's a victory of sorts for Lindsay, who was arrested along with her husband on drug charges in 2006 after police raided their home. All of those charges were dropped. Lindsay says the fact that the city allowed her to open a dispensary is a sign that her name was finally cleared. Still, she says she could reach even more customers if given the chance.
We get probably 40 phone calls a day, and I don't know how many people walking in a day asking if they can come in and buy recreational.
And starting tomorrow, the answer to that question will still be no. October 1st is the date Oregon lawmakers set for medical marijuana dispensaries to be able to sell pot to recreational users, that is, to people without state-issued medical marijuana cards. But the legislature also gave towns the chance to opt out of recreational sales, and that's what the city council did in La Grande, population 13,000. La Grande is one of more than two dozen cities and counties around Oregon that have banned retail sales of recreational marijuana. La Grande Police Chief Brian Harvey.
When you do the commercial component of it, where you've got a store that is no different than a grocery store, you can walk in and get your marijuana, what message does that send to your kids? And how much more does that put out on the street?
Harvey says the council's decision reflects what voters want. Union County voted 59% against last year's statewide measure that legalized recreational marijuana in Oregon.
We have a more conservative populace in eastern Oregon. I don't think that's lost on anyone.
I spent an hour on a downtown La Grande street corner, and only one person I talked to supported the ban on retail sales, but she didn't want to speak on tape. Everyone else I met, from a college student to a retiree, told me they didn't think marijuana was a big deal. Town resident Marie Balaban says she thinks city leaders will eventually change their minds.
Well, I would expect that over time they'll change their opinion because of the income that that business would generate, and because in other places in the state it will be sold recreationally.
Back at Highway 30 Cannabis, I ask owner Ronna Lindsay where she thinks people around La Grande will have to go to buy recreational marijuana. She doesn't miss a beat.
The nearest place is going to be on the street is where they're going to go to get it, and where they are now purchasing it. If they're going to get it, they're going to get it, no, whether it's in a shop or in a street.
And in case you're wondering, Lindsay doesn't fit the stereotype of someone who sells marijuana. When she's not overseeing her dispensary, Lindsay heads down to her day job. She's an administrative assistant at the Union County Chamber of Commerce. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Slaman.
Question, do you think mental decline is an inevitable part of aging? Our brains do shrink as we get older. Well, new research shows that you can actually stretch your brain out again, something called neuroplasticity. You can literally increase brain connections, forge new pathways. You can, for instance, ask yourself questions that just in the asking can make your brain sharper. So, curious to know more? Good. You just woke up part of your brain. We have two guests. Their new book is Staying Sharp, 9 Keys for a Youthful Brain Through Modern Science and Ageless Wisdom. Dr. Henry Emmons is a psychiatrist with Partners in Resilience in Minneapolis. Welcome.
Hello.
Dr. David Alter is a psychologist and co-founder of Partners in Healing, a center for holistic health in Minneapolis as well. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Let's just start, shall we, with number one. Stay active. Now, we know that you should be active as you get older. It keeps you limber. Lots of oxygen makes for better moods. You even say there's science that shows that even walking can enlarge the brain.
No matter how old you are, if you start moving, it is going to be good for your brain. And, you know, you talked about the brain shrinking and brain volume. One thing just to add to that is that there is really good evidence that simply walking for 45 minutes a few days a week correlates with an increase, not just that it slows down the decrease, but people can actually increase the volume of their brains. It also protects your memory. It gives your body a good form of stress. You know, we think about stress as being bad all the time, and it is when we're stressed continuously. But doing something that stresses your body like exercise does, it's exactly what your body wants to do when those stress hormones are elevated.
I can add just a bit, Robin, to that. This is Dr. Alter here. I would say that what the physical, mental, and relational aspects all have in common is that they engage a person more deeply in their day-to-day life. And movement is just a way of becoming more physically engaged.
Being mindful of what you're doing and being part of the world that's moving around you instead of moving past you. So there's movement. Sleep. Let's linger here for a second. For some reason, we think that older people either can't sleep but don't need it. I don't know why I have that feeling, but I don't know where that comes from. You write, though, that it is imperative for everyone for cleaning out the brain. Dr. Emmons, take that.
Yes. One of the recent and really exciting discoveries about how the brain works is that there is a nighttime cleaning crew that comes into the brain while you're sleeping and only while you're sleeping to basically clean out the waste products. And it might explain one of the really important reasons why sleep is so protective against Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. When you sleep deeply, the rest of your brain literally shrinks, and it allows more space for those channels, the glymphatic system, to clean the waste products out.
Or put the things that you want to keep in their proper place of storage.
Exactly.
That's right.
The other, you know, really key element that relates to memory is that during your deep sleep stages, your brain can shift memories from the short-term storage to long-term storage. And if we don't sleep deeply, that doesn't happen. And then people often think mistakenly that they have some kind of dementia because they can't remember. It's simply because it hasn't been put into storage.
And Dr. Alter, we're also reading that good sleep can take the edge off of painful events because of a stress chemical that drops while you sleep?
Sleep in many ways is the repair and restore cycle of a 24-hour day. So when you're sleeping deeply, if we take a typical 6-8 hours of sleep, the first half is devoted to repairing the body, and the second half has a much higher preponderance of dreams. Both of those are times when the body is going through these cycles where cortisol, the stress chemical that you were alluding to, is fluctuating, but overall it's reducing so that the next day you are both energized, you have put memories where they need to be, and you're in a better rejuvenated position to face that next day with some of the kind of cognitive attitudes that we'll be talking about, that optimistic, right, forward-looking way of engaging your day.
Because you've worked through painful memories in a stress-free state towards the end of that long sleep, as you write. It's as if you're giving yourself free therapy as you sleep.
Free therapy, you can't beat that.
That's right.
But I want to move on to food. Each of you, give me one food and one reason why it's so important for keeping your brain sharp.
Well, I can tell you, this is Henry Emmons, that one of the key, probably most important aspect of diet and brain health is that if you eat in a certain way, you will help keep your blood sugar down. And blood sugar, if it gets elevated even a little bit, is just so hard on the brain. It's correlated with shrinkage of the brain tissue. It's correlated with inflammation. And so people who have a sweet tooth, like I do, if they take a few simple measures, for example, having some protein each time they eat, trying to focus their carbohydrates on things that take a long time for the body to digest, those two simple things go a really long ways towards stabilizing your blood sugar.
What I'd add to that, this is Dr. Alter, is that if you think about the phrase mind-body health or mind-body medicine, it sort of suggests a direction that we tend to think that if you take care of the mind, it'll take care of the body. But when you focus on eating, you're really focusing on the reverse, that in many ways what you feed the body is what will then in turn be able to feed or make healthy the mind, the brain.
So what you eat is not just about weight, it's about your brain. I want to get to the last six keys of preventing an aging brain. Things like curiosity, be curious, be flexible in the way you approach life and people, have empathy, be authentic. What if someone's hearing that and saying, oh, no, I am too old to become a curious person? You know, these are personality traits.
I'm not sure that these are, in fact, enduring personality traits. They're not fixed. So if we're talking about curiosity, it's a fundamental attitudinal shift that can begin with broadening your awareness so that it begins to move outside of the usual range of expectations that you have about what you'll do, what you'll get in return, looking for things that you may not have noticed before. And anybody at any age can say, I wonder about.
You can do that. You can repeat questions like that, and your brain can then rewire to make you more curious.
Right.
Robin, if I could share a study that we refer to in the book. This is a study by Ellen Langer that was done some years ago.
We know her well.
You know
she's,
her.
Yeah, oh, she's a leader in the study of mindfulness.
One of her studies from years ago involved taking a number of older adults to an empty monastery and keeping them there for a time. They divided them into two groups, and they had one group act as if they were younger. They reminded them of their early years through music and pictures and newspaper clippings and the like. And they advised them to act like they were in their late teens, early 20s. The other group was not given that recommendation. What they found was that after just a short time, the group that was acting younger had become happier. They had become more engaged. Even things like arthritic fingers got more flexible. They were able to move better. Some of them started playing flag football. I mean, it's just remarkable how powerful the mind is at changing even the things that we don't think of as being changeable.
Yeah. You talk about art, for instance, and seeing beauty. It actually does help our brain.
The brain is insatiably hungry. It is designed for lifelong learning. And part of what closes off the possibility of remaining youthful throughout life is when we begin to feed it primarily what we've already experienced. So curiosity and flexibility and optimism are cognitive dimensions that rest on the idea that you're opening the brain up through using your mind intentionally to bring in new experiences.
Dr. Henry Emmons, a psychiatrist with Partners in Resilience in Minneapolis. Dr. David Alter, psychologist and co-founder of Partners in Healing. Their book, Staying Sharp, 9 Keys for a Youthful Brain. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you very much.
And for their last tip, be authentic. They include a Mae Sarton poem, Now I Become Myself. It's taken time, many years and places. I've been dissolved and shaken, worn other people's faces. The doctors say, find your own.
A poll out this week showed Vice President Joe Biden with a better chance of beating top Republican presidential candidates than Hillary Clinton. And Biden's schedule recently is starting to look like a presidential candidate's schedule. But with just 2 weeks until the first Democratic candidate's debate, Biden still hasn't said whether he is going to run. Jean Cummings is political editor for The Wall Street Journal. She's with us from Washington. Jean, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And what are you hearing at this point about whether Joe Biden is going to get in?
Well, most of the people around him are preparing as though he is going to get into the race. They are interviewing people who could take on key roles in the campaign. They've thought through the map where they think he might be able to inject himself in a positive way, South Carolina being a prime target for them. And they've thought through his messaging. And basically, on the assumption that the economy continues to improve, their thinking is that he can argue that we should stay the course.
And are they prepared for the numbers to start going down as they always do when a non-candidate becomes a candidate?
They absolutely are. These are pros. Some of them were with Biden when he ran his two other presidential campaigns. But you raise a good point. When you look at the polls today, Biden is definitely enjoying a moment when he's not a candidate. And so people, Republicans, independents that can feel good about him today may not feel so when he's running for the Democratic nomination.
So when are you expecting him to actually make an announcement if all that you are hearing is true, that he is going to get in? Because the debate is coming up the week after next.
There's been a lot of internal debate around the vice president about when to pull the trigger, if they're going to do it. We had heard October 1 was kicked around. Next week looks like prime real estate because it's in between and just in the run-up to the October 13th debate. So we don't, to the best of our knowledge with our reporting, the date, if there is going to be one, has not been settled, or at least we haven't uncovered exactly when that might be. And we are always told to be cautious in that until he makes that final decision, then no decision has been made. He's still wrestling some, but he's making every move to prepare to enter the race.
All right, Jean Cummings, political editor with The Wall Street Journal. We'll be watching. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, let's turn now to Jeff Link, a Democratic strategist in Iowa who is so far unaffiliated in the 2016 race. Jeff, your thoughts on what you just heard. Do you agree that Biden will get into the race?
Well, I think what I heard was that ultimately the vice president has to make the final decision. I think it appears that they're putting everything in place to make it an easy yes decision for him, but I don't think he's made a final decision based on anything I've heard.
And how do you think that Democrats would respond if he does get in? I can imagine that there are going to be a lot of people, especially if he gets in and beats Hillary Clinton and wins the nomination, that are going to be angry that he has stopped potentially the first female president from becoming president.
Well, obviously, if he gets into the race, it will shake things up. I think there will be people that will give the vice president a serious look. But, you know, like they've done with the other candidates, certainly here in Iowa, the important thing is telling people where you're going to take the country.
How do you think he will differ in his positions from Hillary Clinton or from Bernie Sanders, for that matter?
I think the vice president has always had a real interest and focus on trying to figure out how to help middle-class families. Secretary Clinton has been talking a lot about middle-class families. She certainly did in her last visit here. And so I think that's, if he does get in, they'd both be sort of fighting on that same turf.
What is the disadvantage of getting in so late if he does get in?
Well, a lot of people have already made up their mind. Secretary Clinton has a lot of supporters. They have an aggressive field program underway in Iowa now, and that means that they've gotten a lot of people to give them commitments. There are, you know, obviously a lot of enthusiastic supporters of Senator Sanders. They might have been available to the vice president early in this process, but now they're on the team with either Sanders or Clinton or O'Malley. So it just makes the number of people available who might be your everyday workers making phone calls and knocking on doors for you, there's just a smaller pool.
One more thing, Jeff. We heard from Gene Cummings that the vice president may shift focus to South Carolina and kind of, if not skip, not spend very much attention on Iowa and New Hampshire. What would you think of that strategy?
You know, when you're vice president, much like Secretary Clinton, I think you got to sort of participate in all 50 states. He's not the kind of candidate that can pick and choose. Now, they may put more emphasis on one state than another, but I think you got to run a 50-state strategy.
That's Jeff Link, a Democratic strategist in Des Moines, Iowa, where he also runs a political and nonprofit consulting firm, Link Strategies. Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And again, Robin, we just don't know yet whether Joe Biden is going to get in. But as Gene Cummings said, maybe we'll find something out next week. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.